Hello, everybody, and welcome to the science of improving patient safety. The objectives of this session are for you to recognize that every system is designed to achieve exactly the results it gets. Second, to identify some basic principles of safe design that apply to both technical work and teamwork. And we'll spend a lot of time making sure you understand these principles that you can use today. And finally, to understand the evidence about how teams make wise decisions and how you could use that evidence in your daily work. Now, I want to begin with a story. It's a story of a young surgeon in training who woke up one morning with slurred speech and tingling in her hand. She had a CAT scan that unfortunately showed a brain tumor. And then she went in to have what's called a functional MRI. It's a scan that measures brain blood flow. And she did it while she curled her fingers. And what the scan showed was that had the surgeons cut through where the part of the brain that they normally would, which is the shortest part, it would have resulted in the loss of the use of her hand and thus her career. So they cut through a larger, though much less active part of her brain, and she woke up with no deficits. This is one of the examples of truly the miracles performed by healthcare that we experience every day. On slide 4, our same healthcare system still leaves sponges in patients. And we reflect on that and say, how could that possibly be? How could we have amongst the best healthcare in the world, state of the art, and the whole world looks to us for innovation, and yet we sometimes make mistakes like leaving sponges in? Now, this issue of mistakes and patient safety is an enormous, enormous problem. It also has a very personal impact. Let's review of what we know. It shows that about 7% of hospitalized patients suffer a medication error. Somewhere between 44,000 to 98,000 people die needlessly from largely mistakes of what we'll call commission. That is, we do things we shouldn't do. Another 100,000 die from healthcare acquired infections. We'll hear much more about that later. Infections that for far too long we thought were inevitable. The evidence says that patients receive about half of the recommended therapies they should. Somewhere between 50 to 100,000 people die from misdiagnosis a year. We don't really know how big it is because quite frankly, we don't have great mechanisms to measure it yet. And all of these errors are enormously expensive. Some are estimating about $50 billion in needless costs. So how could this happen? How could a healthcare system that is the best deliver care that so often falls short? The first reason why it is that we haven't really put science to the delivery of healthcare. Science is finding new genes. Science has been finding new drugs. But how we deliver care, how the information system flows, how the knowledge is shared, how we organize and finance care, has largely been left up to the art of medicine. And as a result, patients suffer needlessly. So if we're going to try to improve that science or build upon it, we need to understand the foundation. And this course, this section is going to give you that foundation. And there's 5 basic principles that we're going to walk through and make sure we understand. The first, and it's a hard pill for some to swallow, is to accept that we are fallible. You see, for too often in healthcare, we've operated under the assumption that doctors and nurses don't make mistakes, that we're perfect, that we expect perfection of ourselves, and when we fall short, which we will inevitably do, there's guilt, there's darkness, there's shame. And it's quite profound when we change our mindset and start assuming that things will go wrong rather than right. That as we approach our work thinking that we know we're human, we're fallible, and therefore we have to defend against mistakes. Some of you who have children may have done this when your toddler started walking and you went through your house removing breakables, putting gates up at the tops of the stairs so that you proactively identified hazards. We don't do that very often in healthcare, and we need to. Second principle is understanding that every system is perfectly designed to achieve the results it gets. That is, it's not workers who are to blame largely when mistakes happen. It's the system. Third is I want you to understand some basic principles of safe design. Now, we'll go into these principles in much more detail in future classes on human factors, but the three principles that I want you to take home are: first, standardize care whenever you could, create checklists or independent checks for things that are important, and learn, don't just recover when things go wrong. Fourth principle is for you to understand that these ideas of safe design don't just apply to the technical work you do, they apply to teamwork. So how you communicate with your colleagues has to be standardized, you need checks, and you have to make sure you learn when things go wrong. And lastly, I want you to understand the overwhelming evidence that teams make wise decisions with diverse and independent input. So that is, make sure if you're on a team, you speak up and say what you are thinking. And if others are leading teams, that you listen to them, because in the end, you'll make wiser decisions. Now, let's go through this idea of systems and see how every system is perfectly designed to achieve the results it gets. Well, there was a patient who was overdosed with morphine. Morphine is a narcotic pain medicine that if you give too much of it, it could stop your breathing. And when that happened, the typical response was, oh, that was the nurse's fault, or that was the doctor's fault, and that was about it. But when we investigated it with this systems lens, we found something very, very different. We found that there was poor communication between the resident doctor and the nurse. The resident ordered something that the nurse suspected was not the right dose, but the nurse didn't speak up because the last time she questioned this doctor, she got barked at and didn't want to put herself in that risk again. We found that the doctor had inadequate training in physician order entry. We found out that there was no protocol for pain management in the physician order entry. We made the doctors guess what the right therapy was rather than supporting them. And there was inadequate decision support tools, that is, tools to catch this overdose. So to put ranges in to say, hey, this dose is out of what normally is prescribed, do you do it? So what superficially may seem like, oops, doctor made a mistake or nurse gave a medicine, in reality is much more complicated, and all these vulnerabilities could have prevented it. Now, this model that I'm showing you on slide 9, which is a model from Jim Reason, perhaps the world's greatest incident investigator, is called the Swiss cheese model, and the holes represent vulnerabilities or hazards in our work environment, and we all have them. And these hazards are dynamic. They change over time. They open and close. And when all the holes align, that is, there's inadequate communication, there's inadequate training, there's lack of protocols and management, errors could occur. But on the upside is closing any one of those holes could protect against the mistake actually reaching the patient. And that's what we're hoping you're going to do as you design and implement information technology systems. Now, on slide 10, I put a taxonomy of different system factors. There's patient characteristics. There's things about the task, like entering an order. There's skills of the individual provider. There's team factors, the way the group works. There's environmental factors, whether it's noisy or dark, all the way up to institutional factors. Now, the point isn't that you memorize this list. What the point is that you develop lenses to start to see these systems, because most people in healthcare are system blind, or at least system myopic. That is, they don't see these things. When things go wrong, they blame the patient or they blame themselves or their colleagues, and they don't think about could lack of a protocol, could lack of training have contributed to the mistakes, and that's what we're going to be expecting you to do. Let me give you another example of this system factors here on slide 11. A patient in the intensive care unit went into a fast heartbeat rhythm. the doctor decided to treat it with a medicine called Esmolol, a short-acting beta blocker that slows the heart rate, a perfectly appropriate choice. He asked the nurse to get the medicine. The nurse got this vial, drew up the vial, and handed it to the resident. The resident assumed it was 10 milligrams a cc because we normally had pre-filled syringes of this medicine, but we had stopped making those pre-filled syringes to save some money. The resident gave 2 cc's, what he thought was 20 milligrams, and the patient's heart stopped. We resuscitated the patient, and in debriefing it, I was standing there and said, "You know, why do you think this happened?" And the resident, again, not having lenses of system, said, "I think the patient must have a bad heart. We better get an echocardiogram to look at it." To which I responded, "I've never seen somebody's heart arrest like this to such a small dose of Esmolol. I think we gave an overdose. Could we simulate what we just did?" And sure enough, we didn't dilute this medicine, and we gave about a 250 times overdose. The case like this makes those who study this stuff, like myself, believe that the estimates of harm are the tips of the iceberg. Now here's, on slide 12, some improvements in aviation safety over time. The improvements are really remarkable. What is generally known is that the early improvements in the mid-60s, late-60s, maybe early 70s, had to do with the jet engine. The jet engine fails much less often than a prop engine. But the improvements later on, at least in the mid-70s and early 80s, were really focused not on technology but on teamwork, because the voice cockpit recorders of several air crashes sounded something very similar to the Air Florida crash that went into the icy Potomac River about 15 years ago now. It was December, cold, rainy day. The flight was behind schedule. And I'm going to paraphrase, not quote exactly from the record, but essentially the flight was behind. It was sleeting out, and the co-pilot was speaking to the pilot. The plane started rolling down the runway. He said, "Captain, wings are boggy." "Captain, we're slow on approach." Plane continues rolling. "Captain, wings are boggy." "Captain, slow on approach." "Captain, slow on approach." "Captain, not going to clear takeoff." "Captain, not going to clear takeoff." "Captain, we're going down." Seven admonitions from a scared pilot, co-pilot, that apparently fell on deaf ears. Now, this wasn't the only case that the National Transportation Safety Board had in which it appeared that pilots just didn't hear words spoken by the co-pilot that were recorded on a voice cockpit recorder. So they brought pilots and co-pilots in to simulate, and what did they find? Well, they found that most often what the pilot had to say or co-pilot had to say was filtered. It was deemed not important, and therefore the pilot didn't need to hear it. So they largely ignored it. Psychologically, they just dismissed it. And many, many crashes occurred because of that. Many errors in healthcare occur because of that, and we can't afford to have that anymore. Okay, so hopefully you have understanding now these lenses to see systems, and importantly, you recognize that that teamwork lens is crucial, absolutely crucial. Now let's move on to the next idea, and that is you understanding the principles of designing safe systems. And they are standardized work whenever you could, and that is either by eliminating steps if possible so the mistake cannot even occur, or standardizing work. Second is to create independent checks, our checklist, for things that are mission critical, things that are really important for you to do. And lastly, learn when things go wrong. You see, in healthcare, we're really, really good at recovering from mistakes, but we're pretty poor at learning, that is, actually reducing the risk that future patients will be harmed. To learn, we need to answer four questions. What happened? Why did it happen? What did you do to reduce risk? And most importantly, how do you know that it actually worked? So let me give you an example. We were trying to reduce catheter infections. You may have read about this in my book, Safe Patients, Smart Hospitals. There are a type of infections that we give patients when they have catheters, typically tubes that go into their neck to deliver medicines or monitor their heart. And what we found is that doctors were supposed to comply with a checklist when they were placing these catheters that required them to cover themselves, to wear a gown, to cover the patient. In essence, they needed about 8 pieces of equipment, but that equipment wasn't stored together. We made our docs run around the hospital seeking it. Oftentimes, it wasn't stocked, and predictably, they would go without it sometimes. So we could have just told them to try harder, but we took a systems approach. So what did we do is we got a cart that stored all the equipment that was needed to comply with this checklist. We standardized the procedure, took 8 steps down to 1, and compliance went up dramatically. You may have seen this in your own life with going to an ATM machine. It's a great example of eliminating steps so errors can't occur. Here on slide 15, you can see in many of the older ATM machines, and perhaps a few of the current ones, you used to put your card in. The machine would keep your card. You'd type in what you want. It would spit out your money, and then it would spit out your card. And many, many people left their cards behind because once we got our money, predictably, we're human, we walk away. And that was a very expensive mistake for banks because they had to go back and correct all the forms and paperwork, and not to say very expensive and annoying for consumers. Now, the banks could have put a sign up on the ATM machine that said, oh, be careful, try harder, be more vigilant. But they didn't. They took a systems approach. And what did they do? In most ATM machines now, you can't even make this mistake because your card never leaves your hand. You swipe it. They eliminated the potential for making this mistake by taking that step out. And as a result, the error leaving your card behind went down several 100 times. Great example of how you could just eliminate a step and make care dramatically safer. Okay, let's go into some independent checks. Now, the greatest example of this is a seatbelt. As you all probably know, there's quite good data that buckling your seats results in improved safety for yourself and your passengers, because without them, we tend to go flying out of cars. But we're human. We get busy. We sometimes forget to do it. So what do most cars have now? An independent check where if you don't buckle your seat once the car is moving, you get either a beep that might get louder, you get a rather annoying voice speaking to you, but some independent check, a reminder to say, hey, buckle your seatbelt, it's important and you forgot. And lo and behold, these things work. I suspect many of you have had this beep go off in your cars and have complied and started buckling your car seat. Remarkably effective. We haven't applied them as much as we could in healthcare. Now, we can't have these things beeping for everything because it would annoy clinicians and work wouldn't be able to get done. So we have to be judicious about thinking about what's most important. Now, let's go to slide 16 where you understand these principles of designing safe systems don't just apply to technical work, but they apply to teamwork. And I love this model of communication because it applies to really any kind of communication you do with your family, with your colleagues, with patients at work. And what it says is that the sender of a message encodes some meaning of that. And that might be the words are ambiguous, so they don't have a direct clarity about what they do, but the more innuendos, there is almost certainly nonverbal communication, either through tone or eye and facial movements. And that message passes through an environment that in healthcare is often noisy, chaotic, and it goes to a receiver who has to get that message and then decode what the meaning was in what you asked them to do. And that decoding could be corrupted. That is, there can be truly a translation error the more the wording is vague, the more the receiver is distracted or not paying attention, the noise of their environment. So let me give you an example. If I come home from work and I say to my wife, oh, I had a rough day at work, she immediately decodes that to say, so what you're saying is you want to go take a jog and not give our kids a bath. And she's absolutely spot on. That's what I was saying. But we're familiar with each other. We have that decoding. And so we don't have a translation error. Most people in healthcare don't know each other that well. We're not that familiar. And so with that, we're at enormous risk for decoding errors when we don't standardize and say explicitly what we mean, when the receiver doesn't read back and create an independent check to ensure that they heard what they said. Let me give you an example. When we make rounds in the ICU now, we have a tool called the Daily Goals. The sender says explicitly what's going to happen for every patient in the intensive care unit. The nurse then reads back and confirms that she heard or he heard what the plan was. And then probably about half the times, they decoded it as a mistake. What they check back to confirm, we then say, no, that's not exactly what I was talking about. What I meant was this. Imagine if you didn't have that read back. Half of the time, there'd be errors that wouldn't get caught. And so applying these principles of standardizing communication, creating independent checks, and then when you communicate erroneously, learn are critically important. Now, this last idea of the science of safety is for you to understand the notion that teams make wise decisions with diverse and independent input. Diverse and independent input. And what that means is that the more lenses you get about a problem, the more input you get from consumers, from patients, from parents, from colleagues, the wiser the decision you're going to make. Now, if you are the decision maker, you ultimately still make the decision. It doesn't compromise your authority, but you will make better decisions when you have a broader and richer view. A great example of this jelly bean test that was written about in a book by Jim Zarwicki called The Wisdom of Crowds. In this, and you may have done it at your church or at a fair, there's oftentimes groups of people will be asked to guess how many jelly beans are in a jar, and whoever gets closest typically will win the jelly beans. What researchers have found is something remarkable, that while any individual guess might be off, in groups, say, over 30 or 50, a large enough group, the group mean is remarkably close, often within a few jelly beans, from what the actual number is. What the idea here is that there's wisdom in this group, that on average, we'll get things right. And the more you can tap into that wisdom in designing information systems, the better off you're going to be. We see so many examples where information systems or code comes down from on high with little input from clinicians or diverse or software programmers, and we're poorer for it. I have a little metaphor about this, and as you may know, Hopkins is a big lacrosse school, and in lacrosse or in soccer, if you get a penalty, you play man down. Now, for the women out there, I tried calling it woman down or person down, but many of the women, even women who play lacrosse, say, well, we still call it man down. So let's go with the phrase man down. When you're in the penalty box, you're clearly disadvantaged. Indeed, several years ago, Johns Hopkins almost threw away the National Lacrosse Championship to Duke when they got a penalty with a few minutes left, and Duke scored several goals when they were man down. Luckily, Hopkins hung on to win the game. But as I watched that, I sat there and thought, why on earth do we voluntarily play man down every day at work and healthcare? By not listening to our patients, by not listening to nurses, by not listening to our colleagues. It's a foolish way to play. We're disadvantaged and we're going to lose. So what you need to do is if you see something or if you think there's a risk, speak up. And when others are speaking up, make sure that you're giving their due. So what's your role and how do you apply these principles in your work? Well, first, if you accept that you're fallible, assume that things will go wrong. Don't believe, no matter how expertise you are in informatics, that you're going to program or do your work flawlessly. You will make mistakes, as we all will, so assume things are going to go wrong so you could defend against them. Secondly, develop lenses to see these systems. When things go wrong, don't just see yourself or your colleagues and patients. Think about training. Think about teamwork. Think about protocols. Third, work to mitigate both the technical and teamwork risks in your environment. Do that by standardizing your work. And that means, for example, limit the number of choices of drugs that people have so you don't have to choose 30 out of a drop-down list. Create independent checks. If something is really, really critical, make sure the information system has a fail-safe to say, oh, this is too important. We have to confirm it's right. And learn from your mistakes. Next is make sure that you apply this knowledge of making wise decisions by getting input from others whenever you make decisions. You don't need to make this work in a vacuum.